Good morning, noon or night, whichever it is for you. It's Harry, my son George, and our two lazy dogs queued up for another episode of Forgettable Ruminations. Thanks to everyone for the mostly positive feedback and reception of last week's bonus episode, the autobiography episode, The Anatomy of a Podcast. That sounds like an early Hitchcock movie, doesn't it? Anatomy of a Podcast. Sounds like I was murdered in the middle of it. And some of you probably wish I had been. Or at the beginning, even better. A Netflix whodunit. There were only four of us there. Me, the body, the victim, and three suspects. George and the dogs. Now, who's going to suspect two lazy dogs? I'd just given them some chicken. They were happy with me. They aren't in my will. They had no motive. That leaves George. But he has the perfect alibi. Blonde hair, blue eyes. And everyone knows, especially criminal profilers at Quantico, that blonde hair and blue eyes never murder. Maybe some embezzlement. Never murder. And George is only three. He is in my will. He's getting the riding mower. He has motive. Maybe it'd be better as one of those Dateline secrets uncovered. I'm thinking Matthew McConaughey is George, or Woody Harrelson. George is stoned all the time, just like them, so either of these fine actors would be perfect. And any dog actors could play these lazy bastard dogs. They just gotta lay there. I think I'd want Meryl Streep to play me. Best actor to step in front of a camera. She could pull it off, too. I'd watch that, if I'd survived my murder. So a few episodes ago, I caught some flack for the phrase, douchebags, dickholes, and dumbasses. Maybe it struck a chord with about 60% of Americans, a little too close to home. Geez, which one am I? I did hit my finger with a hammer while screwing a nail into the wall. Does that make me a dumbass? I wonder. And that's just good, helpful soul-searching. But I think there was some confusion as to the difference between them. Confusion as to definition. And I'll try to clear it up. A douchebag is a guy who roller skates naked down the COVID wing of the hospital wearing his mask as a jockstrap. A dickhole is a woman who coughs in the face of someone complaining about her masklessness. And a douchebag is the person, man or woman, who wears their mask around their neck while talking on their cell phone in a crowded store. So with that cleared up, we introduce this week's contestants, a New York City couple kicked off the Brooklyn Ferry for refusing to wear masks. Are they douchebags? Are they dickholes? Or are they dumbasses? Door number one, door number two, or door number three? And a little context before you make your decision. These people boarded the ferry, maskless. Other riders complained. The ferry's captain ordered the couple off the ferry, pursuant to a New York City ordinance requiring masks in public conveyances. The couple refused to leave the ferry. Police arrived. The couple argued with the police, claiming they had documented respiratory conditions which exempted them from compliance. And, of course, they didn't have the documentation on them. So police arrested them for disorderly conduct, and the couple was whisked away in his and her handcuffs to thunderous applause. Dickholes, right? Pretty cut and dry. But here's where it gets tough. The man was smoking a cigarette, and the woman was crying discrimination against a white person. And what to make of these flathead flat earthers? And George split his vote. He was torn. The man, pure dumbass. How do you think your respiratory condition feels about the Camel non-filter you're huffing? Just wait till that coronavirus sets up shop in your compromised lungs. The woman, douchebag. A white person claiming discrimination is douchebaggery of archetypal scale. And solid arguments both for George, proof of his advanced critical thinking skills. I, on the other hand, copped out. I chose door number 4, all of the above. And in case our contestants can pick up forgettable ruminations on death row where they belong, a word of caution, a friendly and free piece of advice. If you're ever driving uphill on a dark night and can't see what's on the other side, approach slowly. You may have found the edge of the earth. And that's it for this edition of Douchebags, Dickholes, and Dumbasses. If you'd like to nominate a friend or loved one for our consideration, contact me at buymeacoffee.com/Harry and George, all one word, and we'll consider him for our next episode of Douchebags, Dickholes, and Dumbasses. All right, on to the serious shit. You may recall that in a previous episode, I questioned the staying power of the Black Lives Matter protests. And my reasoning, which I didn't mention at the time, was that these protesters couldn't overcome the apathy of today's youth. And I waged the old man complaints, the sorriness of today's youth, the loudness of the unplugged radio. It was just reverse age discrimination. And of course, it isn't youth that's saddled with apathy. They're saddled with idealism. It's people my age, people with mortgages, children to raise, yards to maintain. We navigate what's right in front of us. Idealism is a luxury of youth. It's their turn to make the world how they want it to be, one they want to live in, raise their children in. But these protesters are going to encounter resistance from those who like things just the way they are. And I read an article about the Black Lives Matter protest written 10 days after the protest began. I just recently read it, but it was written 10 days after the protest began. And the writer is an academic who had been active in the 60s protests, anti-war, gay rights, racial equality, gender equality, all those things. And this guy had kept detailed journals, so his memory wasn't compromised by the side effect of nostalgia, which is filtering out the not-so-great parts from memory, just good old day syndrome. And this academic was the first one I heard say that these protests have a different feel than any of the others. And because protesters generally protest against policies that are unfair to them. Yet the Black Lives Matter protesters are more than 50% white. So these protesters are marching to change a system that intrinsically benefits them. White people marching against white privilege. So this academic, this commentator, concluded, before it became commonly held, that these protests are different. Unlike me, he was confident of the staying power. He was optimistic about it. But he did warn of counter-protesters and of what nature they would be. And I try to give these counter-protesters the benefit of the doubt that maybe they have some honest or even noble purpose that I wasn't thinking of. And maybe a more sympathetic mind, a more thorough one, can find that purpose. The counter-protesters claim they are standing up for the authority of the police.
Bullshit level, DEFCON 5!
That's right, George. That's right. Some of these counter-protesters travel 500 miles to protect local police and police stations from the ill effects of Molotov cocktails. Now, none of us care about a police station 500 miles away. Well, we've come to protect businesses from looting.
Oh, come on now. That ain't even bullshit. That's horseshit.
Right. No one cares if the Krispy Kreme three states over receives a brickogram through their window. They pass 20 of these disgusting fried dough emporia along the way, and they're not standing guard over any of those donuts. You know, that'd be a good road trip. touring the country, stopping at every Krispy Kreme and ordering a complimentary water. And Target. Come on, man. Don't want a brick through your window? Change your fucking logo. Or put Walmart's logo in the bullseye position of your logo. And these counter-protesters stand for one idea alone. Racism is A-okay. That's their governing principle. God forbid competition for jobs and political office should be based on merit. I wasn't raised that way. You remember that Uncle Sam poster? The old man in the red, white, and blue suit pointing his finger. I want you. For whites, it was an honor. Made him feel needed. For blacks, that pointed finger meant, watch your ass. Stay away from white women. I want you. In jail. And so many of these counter-protesters are not just racist. They're white supremacists. Though they prefer white nationalists in many cases. It almost sounds patriotic. And they got their inspiration and their courage from the federal stormtroopers sent to Portland to detain people without cause, to search them without cause. And they were dressed, these stormtroopers, like a secret force dropped into Lebanon for clandestine missions against ISIS. These alt-right white supremacist groups are generally anti-government. They protested Ruby Ridge. They protested Waco. They applauded Portland. They fined some pseudo-intellectual half-wit to sue the government over its right to levy and collect taxes. Oddly, they are pro-government when unidentified government stormtroopers are dropped under the cover of night to protect good old red, white, and blue racism. And you know what you don't hear? What you don't hear? A peep from the leadership of alt-right groups. Not a word. And here's why. They know that if this practice of using a domestic Delta Force becomes accepted practice, they're next. The leadership knows they're under constant surveillance, and they know the Department of Homeland Security lists alt-right groups as the gravest threat to social order. That's you, white supremacists. They read your Facebook posts, your tweets. They develop psychological profiles of you. You're angry. That's okay with the department. You have stockpiles of weapons and ammunitions. And that's where the Department of Homeland Security gets their Titan sphincters. The sheer abundance of your deadly toys. You know who the Department of Homeland Security doesn't find particularly troublesome? Antifa. In reports on domestic threats from the department, Antifa barely gets a whisper in some and not at all in others. Antifa needs to kick it up a notch. They need to maybe knock off a few Krispy Kremes or hit the bullseye in that damn Target logo. Maybe he'll get on the list then. But for now, white supremacists have the whole top 10 to themselves. They are the Ivy League of domestic terrorism. And they will remain so until the deep state unleashes Antifa to set them on fire. Whew. It's burdensome carrying the intellectual weight of the Black Lives Matter movement while sitting on my ass. It's wearing me out. George and I need a brain break. Even these dogs are emotionally exhausted. Neither has licked their butts in hours. So in previous episodes, George and I took hard looks at the amendments to our Constitution, finding iconic moments for them. And we dropped the ball a little in that last episode, the bonus episode, with the Third Amendment, the Housing of Soldiers in Peacetime Amendment. Easily the dumbest of these 27 add-ons. It's hard to believe it's even mentioned in such an historic document when it more appropriately belongs in a fortune cookie. But this week, the Fourth Amendment, the porterhouse steak of amendments. Got some tenderloin, got some strip. And if you watched any episode of Law and Order, you know the Fourth Amendment. Securing your person, illegal search and seizure, probable cause, gotta have a warrant. One of the white supremacists' favorite amendments. But even this one has been defanged. It's been watered down by the concept, exigent circumstances. If we'd followed procedure for obtaining a warrant, something terrible would have happened in the interim. Say it's an hour before Super Bowl kickoff. Tom Brady is nowhere to be found. The police have received an anonymous tip as to Brady's whereabouts. But the judge has indulged in some pregame festivities, slurped down a vat of bourbon, and is too drunk to sign a warrant application. In such an instance, the police are legally justified in busting through Bill Belichick's door, rushing down to the basement, untying Tom Brady from the underinflated blow-up mattress, and rushing him to the stadium. That's exigent circumstances, because who wants a Super Bowl without Tom Brady? But George and I usually go contemporary for our iconic moment, but this time we're going to the future. A prediction of our iconic moment of the Fourth Amendment. Once we have a coronavirus vaccine, there will be those who refuse to take it based on their Fourth Amendment right to be secure in their person. And in legalese, that's your body, your person. And you can't be secure in your person if the government injects you with autism. And our rationale for this predicament, or this prediction, is the growing number of people buying phony mask exemption cards online. If you're too stupid to protect yourself from a virus that has killed 200,000 Americans, maybe a little shot of autism will help you. And for those of you legitimately on the spectrum, I apologize for lumping you together with these morons. And that is our iconic moment of the Fourth Amendment.
That was easy.
So most of you have surmised by now, making podcasts is not my job. You've rightly thought there's no way in hell this guy gets paid for this. I don't. And most of it's plagiarized anyway. I'm a cook. At least that's what it says on my paycheck. Department, cook. I'm a good cook, not a great one. I won't beat Bobby Flay anytime soon. Unless I had a big stick. If I had a big stick, I'd beat him. I'd beat the red out of his hair. But I could probably beat him too if he could use ingredients found only at a Super Lube. It'd be my bolognese versus Bobby's bowl of roasted poblano pinzoil, because he always seems to have a roasted poblano hidden somewhere on his person. Anyway, the restaurant I work at is called Cool Beans Cafe. And no, it's not a coffee shop. The owner is a literate British chap named Keith Baxter. That should be good for a raise. I once asked him why he named his restaurant after the catchphrase of one of these vapid 80s sitcoms. Family Ties, Full House, Cosby's. I don't remember. I could Google it, but I don't want to be traumatized by even the slightest exposure to that swill. But Keith told me that the name was indeed not inspired by the 80s TV, but from a quote in one of Shakespeare's early plays, Titus Andronicus. When Titus's only loyal son Lucius says, "I got your back, Dad," Titus responds, "Cool beans, dude." And like most Americans, I'm impressed by the Brits' quoting of Shakespeare. Gives them some intellectual credibility. Their accents just sell it. And until I read Titus Andronicus, I was fooled. I was his dupe, a gullible American doofus. And as it turns out, Keith was completely full of shit. And, well, there goes my race. Nowhere in the play does Titus say cool beans. But it was well worth the read. Three of my favorite themes, murder, rape, and dismemberment, especially dismemberment. Kind of sounds like that new reboot of the Golden Girls, doesn't it? But Keith admitted, pulling my leg, cool beans does not come from Act 5 of Titus Andronicus. As we all know, it comes from Act 3 of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. And with that kind of leadership, it's easy to see why Cool Beans has succeeded for 24 years. 24 years kicking ass, despite some setbacks in the last 6 months. 24 years, dozens of awards, consistently number one or two on Yelp and TripAdvisor. Well, we reopen on September 17th. And even with the historical success and strong brand recognition, there is some white-knuckling among us. Will the safety protocols be too burdensome? Will the half-filled dining room kill that pleasant ambience of a booming restaurant? Will some saboteur claim on his Facebook page that he contracted coronavirus at Cool Beans Cafe? Will diners relax their standards of risk aversion? And the scariest of them all, will a local spike in cases force another shutdown? Tom Colicchio addressed this very issue. He's the bald judge on Top Chef and a world-class chef and restaurant owner. He said another shutdown could kill up to 70% of local restaurants. And this guy isn't just some alarmist making an uneducated guess. Colicchio is the head of the Independent Restaurant Association. His estimate is based on data from a reasonable sample size. He's spoken to other successful restaurateurs, asking them how close they are to the cliff's edge. He has reasons for such a dire prediction. And if you want something a little cheerier, the California Restaurant Association checks in at a mere 30 to 40%. And after we've passed through COVID-19 and the demand for dining out returns, who's going to create the supply? Are entrepreneurs and wannabe restaurateurs going to be reluctant to jump feet first into such a labor-intensive, low-margin business? What about banks? Venture capitalists? They may find restaurant startups too risky. But the corporates can fill the void. Many of them sit on mounds of cash or have exorbitant equity lines of credit. The corporates are going to win this pandemic. And this isn't a diatribe against corporations. They employ millions of people and often contribute positively to communities. But there will be a loss of flavor, an homogenization of food culture. And really, it's just a continuation of what Walmart and Amazon have already done to mom-and-pops, shoe stores, and clothing stores, pharmacies. It's a long list. And it's turned shopping from a pleasant stroll to a task to be completed. Loss of flavor, loss of unique community culture. And I'll give you an example of what could be lost. Could. The dire prediction is just one of several possible scenarios. Anyway, the example of local flavor. Whenever one of our regulars at Cool Beans Cafe falls ill or has been hospitalized, our owner brings them food on the house, to their homes, or to the hospital. That's pretty cool. Damn nice. And here's the star on top of that Christmas tree. He brings them their favorites. Not just something he feels like whipping up. Their favorites. Even if their favorites are what landed them in the hospital in the first place. And Walmart and Amazon will bring your favorites too. Right to your front door. For $100 a year. Just another business transaction. Bringing favorites bedside to the hospital is not a transaction. It's human empathy. Which do you want as your neighbor? Well, that's it for another heartwarming, cheery episode of Forgettable Ruminations. A few shout-outs before we go. Cool Beans Cafe for employing a kidney challenge cook and for just being outright cool. And another, Tommy's Auto Service on Woodville Highway in Tallahassee, best auto shop in town. Your car breaks down, you take it to Tommy. As a matter of fact, and this is true, I had a car issue last week, took it to Tommy, and it's pretty close to running again. And he let me pay him in chickens on the installment plan. Also, I've created my own page on buymeacoffee.com. Just type in buymeacoffee.com/Harry and George, all one word. And there you can shoot me a message or donate to help cover the cost of your entertainment. You know that extra money you made from unemployment compensation? That extra money beyond what you would make for working? I can't think of a better place for it than in my pocket. And you can get it there through buymeacoffee.com. And as usual, don't forget to rate and comment Unforgettable Ruminations on your favorite podcast platform. Till next time, it's Harry, my son George, and our two lazy dogs. Thanks for listening.